So the way I look at it is the sooner I'm euthanized, the sooner I can go back. I have better things to do with my time than spend the next 15 or 20 years on death row. Murder, death, execution are common themes in every story on today's channel. Robert Frauda has been on death row for nearly 3 decades and is scheduled to be executed tomorrow night in Huntsville. From the prostitute who kills her clients to the deviant whose tactics included strangulation, beatings, and torture. The list goes on and on. Here are the most disturbing last wishes of those on death row. "Don't cry, Mom, I beg you not to cry." Victor Fieger. Victor Harry Fieger was a drifter who arrived in the town of Dubuque, Iowa, in the summer of 1960. His disheveled appearance and mysterious aura made him an object of curiosity among the locals, who had no idea that he would soon commit a heinous crime. After renting a room in a boarding house, Fieger hatched a sinister plan. He began calling local doctors in alphabetical order from the phone book, pretending to have a medical emergency. When the respected Dr. Edward Bartles answered, Fieger kidnapped him. Days later, Bartles' body was found in an Illinois cornfield with a single gunshot wound to the head. Fieger's motive was to steal drugs from Bartles to sell across state lines for his own profit. He attempted to cover his tracks by selling Bartles' car in Alabama, which alerted the authorities. The FBI tracked Fieger down based on the buyer's suspicions. At his federal trial for the doctor's kidnapping and murder, Fieger desperately claimed that a fictitious Chicago drug addict was the real killer. But investigators found no corroborating evidence. The overwhelming evidence led to Fieger's conviction and death sentence, despite pleas for clemency to President Kennedy. As Fieger awaited execution on Iowa's death row, he remained an enigmatic figure. For his last meal, he strangely requested a single olive with the pit, hoping that an olive tree would sprout from his grave to symbolize peace. He spent his final hours in vigil with a priest. On March 15, 1963, Fieger was dressed, taken to the Orca, and hanged in front of reporters and officials. Eerily, the olive pit was found in his pocket, a memento of his gesture for peace. His body was buried in an unmarked grave. Fieger's gruesome crime and execution came as a shock to many. Former death penalty advocate John Ellie's mind was forever changed by witnessing the haunting hanging. Fieger's case also contributed to Iowa abolishing capital punishment just 2 years later in 1965. While the debate over the death penalty continued across the country, his tragic story highlighted the complexities of the value of life and the ethics of capital punishment. Ronnie Lee Garner. It all began in the fall of 1984, when Ronnie Lee Garner, a troubled and volatile individual, embarked on a path of darkness that would forever change his life and the lives of those around him. In a chilling act of brutality, Garner committed murder during a robbery, leaving a community in shock and law enforcement determined to bring him to justice. The details of that fateful day are forever etched in the history books. It was a crisp October morning when Garner, armed and driven by a sense of desperation, confronted his unsuspecting victim. In a moment of sheer terror, a life was snuffed out, forever altering the course of events that would follow. Authorities quickly launched an intense manhunt, determined to apprehend Garner and end his reign of terror. But Garner, driven by a desperate desire to elude capture, would soon find himself entangled in an even more sinister plot. In April 1985, Gardner, facing trial for his previous crimes, hatched an audacious plan to escape from the courthouse where he was being held. Armed with a contraband firearm, he embarked on a desperate bid for freedom. Garner's daring escape attempt erupted into chaos. In a moment of desperation, he fatally shot an attorney who had been assigned to his case. The deafening sound of gunshots echoed through the halls of justice, leaving those present in a state of shock and disbelief. The consequences of Garner's brazen act of violence were swift and decisive. It didn't take long for him to be arrested, his dreams of freedom shattered, and his fate sealed. The wheels of justice began to turn, and Garner was left facing the full weight of the legal system. As the trial reached its climax, the jury returned its verdict. Garner was found guilty of 2 counts of murder. On the first count, he was sentenced to life in prison, a fate that would ensure he would spend the rest of his days behind bars. But it was the second count that would seal his fate, as the judge handed down the maximum sentence, death by firing squad. During the appeals, Gartner's defense cited his difficult childhood and lack of good role models as reasons for his turn to crime. His case sparked much debate about the death penalty. Supporters argued that the execution was a just punishment for his terrible crimes. Death penalty opponents argued that firing squads were cruel and that executions were unfair, especially for minorities. The controversy caused people to take a closer look at whether the death penalty actually curbs crime and the risk of executing innocent people. Garner's controversial case reignited heated debates about these larger death penalty issues. However, despite the controversy and passionate arguments from both sides, Ronnie Lee Garner's execution was carried out as planned. His final wish was unique. He chose to spend his final hours binge-watching the entire Lord of the Rings trilogy along with an order of steak, lobster tail, apple pie, vanilla ice cream, and 7-Up as his last meal. His wish was granted. I guess you could say he went out with a bang. William Bonning. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, the streets of Southern California became the hunting ground of a sadistic predator. His name was William Bonin, but he would become infamous as the Freeway Killer. It all began in May 1979, when Bonin's first victim fell into his clutches. A young hitchhiker, lured by the promise of a ride, unknowingly fell into the clutches of a monster. Bonin's reign of terror had begun. Over the next year, Bonin's insatiable appetite for violence and sadism drove him on a series of brutal murders. His victims were young men and women, unsuspecting souls who crossed the path of this ruthless killer. One by one, their lives were brutally taken, their bodies dumped like litter along the very freeways that crisscrossed the region. The bodies of these young men became haunting reminders of the evil that lurked in the shadows. Bonin's crimes were characterized by extreme violence and sexual sadism. He would often pick up his victims and trick them into his vehicle. Once inside, he would subject them to unimaginable horrors. Strangulation, beatings, and torture became the hallmarks of Bonin's sadistic acts. He reveled in their pain and delighted in their screams and suffering. The depths of his depravity seemed to know no bounds. Bonin's victims ranged in age from their teens to their 20s. They came from all walks of life, and their only common thread was their tragic encounter with the highway killer. As the body count mounted, fear gripped the community. Parents warned their children to be careful, to avoid hitchhiking and accepting rides from strangers, but for some, it was too late. Bonin's crimes were not confined to any particular area. From Los Angeles to Orange County, his reign of terror spread like a dark cloud, leaving a trail of devastation in its wake. The police investigation into the crimes of the highway killer was relentless. Detectives worked tirelessly to piece together the puzzle and bring this sadistic killer to justice. But Bonin proved to be a cunning adversary, always one step ahead. It wasn't until June 1980 that Bonin's reign of terror came to an end. After a year of terrorizing the community, he was finally apprehended by law enforcement. The highway killer had been captured. The investigation was a race against time, as each passing day meant another potential victim fell prey to the sadistic whims of the highway killer. But the dedicated detectives refused to give up, determined to bring this ruthless killer to justice. Finally, in June 1980, a major breakthrough came. Law enforcement received a tip that led them to William Bonin's door. The highway killer had been identified, and the net was closing in. On the day of his arrest, Bonin was taken into custody without incident. The former predator now found himself on the wrong side of the law, facing the consequences of his heinous crimes. The trials that followed were dramatic. The courtroom was filled with tension as the prosecution presented a mountain of evidence against Bonin, linking him to the brutal murders that had plagued the region. Survivors of Bonin's sadistic acts bravely took the stand and recounted the horrors they had suffered at the hands of the highway killer. Their testimony painted a vivid picture of the depths of Bonin's depravity, leaving the jury and spectators shocked. The defense, for its part, attempted to paint a different picture of Bonin. They argued that his troubled upbringing and alleged history of sexual abuse had played a role in his violent behavior, but the prosecution countered by emphasizing the calculated nature of Bonin's crimes and the lack of remorse he displayed. After a long and emotional trial, the jury returned its verdict. William Bonin was found guilty of multiple counts of murder, child molestation, robbery, and sodomy. The courtroom erupted in a mix of relief and grief as the victims' families finally saw justice served. Bonin's fate was sealed. He was sentenced to death, ending his reign of terror. But the impact of his sadistic acts would live on forever in the hearts and minds of those affected. He wanted to die of diabetes before he was executed, so he drank 18 servings of Coca-Cola and Pepsi and 3 servings of chocolate ice cream before his execution. In 1996, 16 years after his arrest, William Bonin met his final fate. He was executed by lethal injection, ending one of the most chilling chapters in American criminal history, Philip Ray Workman. In the small town of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, on June 1, 1953, Philip Ray Workman was born into a military family. He grew up on various army bases and experienced a childhood filled with constant change and uncertainty. But as he entered adulthood, Workman's life took a dark turn. After enlisting in the military, Workman's troubles began to surface. Shortly after his discharge in 1973, he became embroiled in a web of criminal activity. In Georgia, he was sentenced to 5 years in prison for robbery and drug possession. After serving just 25 months, it became clear that Workman's criminal tendencies were far from curtailed. Workman's criminal record did not end there. He had a prior conviction for aggravated assault, a testament to his violent tendencies. It seemed that Workman was on a path of self-destruction, fueled by a life of addiction and crime. In 1981, at the age of 28, Workman was living in Columbus, Georgia, with his wife and young daughter, but his cocaine addiction had taken over his life. Desperate for money to feed his addiction, Workman embarked on a fateful journey that would forever change his destiny. Workman hitchhiked to Memphis, Tennessee, where he set his sights on a Wendy's restaurant. On that fateful day, August 5, 1981, armed with a .45 caliber semi-automatic pistol, Workman entered the restaurant with one intention: to rob it. Chaos ensued as Workman brandished his weapon and demanded money from the terrified employees. Little did he know that his actions would have far-reaching consequences, resulting in a tragic loss of life. A restaurant employee, desperate to escape the tense situation, activated a silent alarm. Within moments, 3 Memphis police officers, Ronald Oliver, A. Stoddard, and Stephen Parker, responded to the distress call. When officers arrived, Workman attempted to flee through a nearby parking lot. At that moment, tragedy struck. Lieutenant Ronald Oliver, a dedicated law enforcement officer, was shot and killed. Workman was charged with the murder of Lieutenant Oliver. At his 1982 trial, officers Stoddard and Parker testified that they did not witness Workman shoot Lieutenant Ronald Oliver. The defense, accepting the police version of events, failed to conduct any forensic or ballistic analysis and failed to investigate the testimony of crucial eyewitnesses. The prosecution relied heavily on the testimony of Harold Davis, an alleged eyewitness who claimed to have seen Workman shoot Lieutenant Oliver from just 10 feet away. However, years later, Davis recanted his testimony, admitting that he had provided false information to raise money for his drug addiction. Davis's recantation raised significant doubts about the accuracy of his original testimony. Other eyewitnesses testified that they had not seen Davis at the scene of the crime. Furthermore, the police report made no mention of Davis's presence. Ballistics evidence also raised doubts about Workman's guilt. Dr. Sile W., a respected expert, testified that Lieutenant Oliver's gunshot wound was not consistent with the type of ammunition used by Workman. He argued that it was unlikely that Workman's .45 caliber weapon fired the fatal shot. Dr. Week's professional opinion was based on the fact that hollow point ammunition fired from a .45 caliber weapon does not normally pass through the body, but remains inside the victim. However, the exit wound from Lieutenant Oliver's body was smaller than the entry wound, suggesting that a different caliber weapon was used. Despite these doubts, the jury found Warman guilty of murder during the commission of a felony. The jury recommended the death penalty, citing 5 statutory aggravating circumstances, including the murder of a law enforcement officer. Over the years, doubts about Workman's guilt continued to haunt jurors, prosecutors, judges, and even the victim's family. 5 of the jurors who convicted Workman in 1982 signed affidavits waiving their convictions or verdicts, expressing reasonable doubts about his guilt. In 2000, 2 Tennessee Supreme Court justices expressed concerns about the case. They asked Governor Don Sundquist to commute Workman's sentence, citing the lack of evidence and the possibility of a wrongful conviction. Despite these uncertainties, Workman's conviction was upheld, and he was sentenced to death. As his execution date approached, he selflessly requested a vegetarian pizza to give to a homeless man. His request was denied, but it sparked an outpouring of generosity and compassion across the country. On May 9, 2007, Philip Ray Workman was executed by lethal injection. Alan Warnos. Born on February 29, 1956, in Rochester, Michigan, Alan Warnos attacked and killed 7 male clients while working as a prostitute in Florida in the late 1980s and early 1990s. Claiming self-defense, Warnos claimed that her victims had raped or attempted to rape her. However, the grisly details of her crimes raise questions about justice, mental illness, and the enigmatic nature of human behavior. From a young age, Warnos was sexually abused, a trauma that would profoundly impact her later years. Her mother, Diane Warnos, struggled with her own demons and was unable to provide a stable home for Aizen. As a result, Warnos was left to fend for herself, often relying on survival instincts that would later manifest in her criminal activities. At age 14, Warnos experienced another traumatic event that would further contribute to her troubled life. She was raped by an acquaintance and became pregnant unintentionally. Warnos gave birth to a child she could not care for and who was given up for adoption. This loss and the trauma of the rape deepened Warnos' emotional scars, fueling her anger and resentment toward men. As Warnos entered adulthood, she found herself trapped in a cycle of criminal activity. She engaged in prostitution, theft, and assault, struggling to make ends meet and survive in a world that had shown her little kindness. It was around this time that she met her partner Tyria Moore in 1986. Together they formed a bond that would both support and enable Warnos' decline into violence. Warnos' murder spree began in 1989 and lasted for approximately a year. She would target middle-aged men in self-defense, claiming that her victims had raped or attempted to rape her. However, as evidence began to emerge, it became clear that some of her victims posed no immediate threat to her. Her motivations for her crimes were complex and rooted in a deep-seated anger and desire for revenge against a world that had treated her harshly. She also blamed the police for failing to act after one of her murders. "Let them know that I know that the police knew who I was. After Richard Maller died, I left footprints all over the place and they covered it up and let me kill the rest of those guys and become a serial killer." In 1991, Warnos was finally caught and arrested. During his trial, his troubled past and mental instability came to light. He was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder and antisocial personality disorder, shedding light on the psychological factors that contributed to his violent acts. Despite his attempts to introduce evidence of his victims' prior convictions at trial, Warnos was denied the opportunity. She was convicted of murder and sentenced to 6 death sentences, marking the end of her reign of terror. On October 9, 2002, Alan Warnos was executed by lethal injection at the age of 46. His last words were, "Yeah, I'd like to say I'm sailing with the Rock and I'll be back like Independence Day with Jesus on June 6th. Like in the movie, The Big Mothership and all that, I'll be back, I'll be back." Strange ending to a very strange story. Odell Barnes. The grisly true crime story of Odell Barnes Jr. begins with the brutal 1989 murder of 42-year-old Helen Bass in Wichita Falls, Texas. Barnes, a construction worker with a troubled past, was quickly identified as the prime suspect. The evidence against Barnes seemed irrefutable. His fingerprints were on a lamp used as a weapon, his semen on the victim's body, and two stains of Bass's blood on his clothing. Eyewitnesses also claimed to have seen him trespassing in the vicinity of his home shortly before the murder. When he was arrested, he even had Bass's .32 caliber pistol in his possession. Despite being appointed public defenders ill-equipped to adequately defend him, Barnes was swiftly convicted and sentenced to death by a jury after just 3 hours of deliberation. The conviction devastated both the victim and Barnes' family in the courtroom. However, this was just the beginning of a legal battle that would drag on for years and garner international attention. After new lawyers secured funding to conduct additional forensic testing during the appeals process, shocking revelations began to emerge that challenged the prosecution's story. DNA testing confirmed the presence of Barnes' semen, contradicting his claims that he had not had sexual contact with Bass. But the new defense team also discovered serious flaws in the other evidence used to convict him. The lamp, supposedly new, was not, and small bloodstains had unusually high levels of preservative, raising suspicions of tampering. As these flaws and inconsistencies came to light, human rights groups such as the French began to protest what they saw as a potentially unfair conviction. Questioned the credibility of prosecution witnesses. Despite mounting doubts about the evidence, appeals ultimately failed to exonerate Barnes. On March 2, 2000, after requesting a final meal representing justice, equality, and world peace, he was executed by lethal injection in Texas. In a final statement, he proclaimed his innocence while thanking his supporters. The case of Odell Barnes Jr. is a cautionary tale of how flawed evidence, poor legal representation for the indigent, and ultimately the failure to conclusively prove innocence can lead to a potentially unjust execution. It raises critical questions about the death penalty and the integrity of convictions that still linger decades later. Lawrence Russell Brewer. Lawrence Russell Brewer's name has become infamously linked to one of the most brutal racial hate crimes in modern American history. Born in 1967 in Texas, Brewer's early life was marked by the racist ideologies that permeated his environment. He was drawn into the world of white supremacist prison gangs, where his hatred of other races was allowed to fester unchecked. In 1998, Brewer's vile racism reached its peak when, along with his accomplices, Sean Berry and John King, he murdered James Byrd Jr. in the most cruel and inhumane way imaginable, dragging the 49-year-old black man behind a pickup truck for nearly 3 miles before dismembering his body. Their motivation was pure racial hatred and a desire to terrorize. The savage murder of the beloved Beard shocked the close-knit town of Jasper and sparked outrage across the country. In its wake, the community came together in powerful displays of unity, mourning vigils and marches while demanding justice for the perpetrators. The trial was a pivotal moment, as Brewer and King became the first white men in Texas history to be convicted of murder. To death for killing a black person. Their punishments reflected the particularly heinous nature of his racist behavior. Sean Berry received a life sentence. Byrd's murder had a profound and lasting impact far beyond the courtroom. It inspired the passage of a hate crimes law in Texas that allows for harsher punishments for racially motivated violence. On the federal level, the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act expanded resources for investigators and recognized this gap in the law. For the Byrd family, the grieving process transformed into an inspiring movement for racial healing. The James Byrd Foundation for Racial Healing was established to promote education and community awareness in the fight against racism and hate. Byrd's son, Ross, has been a particularly powerful voice in the fight against capital punishment and the cycle of violence. Before Brewer's execution, He requested a final meal that led to the end of final meal requests in Texas. The meal included two chicken fried steaks with gravy and a side of chicken. Sliced onions, a triple meat bacon cheeseburger, a cheese tortilla with ground beef, tomatoes, onions, peppers, and jalapenos, a bowl of fried okra with ketchup, a pound of barbecue steak on a half loaf of white bread, three loaded fajitas, a meat lover's pizza, a pint of Bluebell vanilla ice cream, a piece of peanut butter fudge topped with crushed peanuts, and three root beers. When presented with the meal, she told officials she wasn't hungry and didn't eat any of it. The food was thrown away, prompting State Senator John Hart to call on Texas prison officials to end the 87-year-old tradition of giving condemned inmates their last meal. Dan and Joy chattered, the year was 1990 when the lives of two families would be changed forever. Heddle Park, an 18-year-old high school girl, lived with her parents and older brother. On the third floor of the Anand Apartments in Bhawaniore, Kolkata. Little did they know that their peaceful existence was about to be shattered. Dan and Joy Chatterjee, a security guard for the agency that managed the apartments. He had been working there for about 3 years. He appeared to be an ordinary man, but beneath the surface, a sinister plan was brewing. On the fateful day of March 5, 1990, Heddle set off to write her ICSE exams, full of hopes and dreams for the future. Her parents bid her farewell, not knowing that it would be the last time they would see their beloved daughter alive. After completing the exam, Heddle returned home expecting to find solace within the walls of her family's flat, but little did she know that danger lurked in the shadows, waiting to strike. In the afternoon, Heddle's mother went to visit a nearby temple, leaving her daughter alone in the flat. That's when the unthinkable happened. On her return from the temple, Heddle's mother found herself locked in her own house. Despite her desperate attempts to enter, the door remained locked, isolating her from her daughter's fate. Heddle's mother called on servants from neighboring flats to help force the door open. What they discovered inside would haunt her nightmares forever. Heddle's lifeless body lay near the door that connected the living room to her parents' bedroom. Bloodstains marred her face and the floor, a chilling testament to the brutality of the crime. The shock and grief that gripped the Peretz family were immeasurable. Their beloved daughter, full of life and potential, had been taken from them in the most cruel way imaginable. As the investigation unfolded, all eyes turned to Dan and Joy Chatterjee, the security guard who had been entrusted with the safety of the building's residents. Suspicion hung in the air and the search for justice began. In the early hours of May 12, 1990, the police arrested Dan and Joy at his home in Kaludiji village near Chatna, Bankura. The weight of evidence against him was overwhelming and the case was handed over to the detective branch of the Kolkata police. The charge sheet prepared by the police included charges of rape, murder, and theft of a wristwatch. The trial was held in the second court of the additional sessions judge, Alipur, where the fate of Dan and Joy Chatterg was to be decided. With no direct witnesses to the murder, the case relied heavily on circumstantial evidence. The prosecution painted a chilling picture of Dan and Joy's guilt, while the defense fought tooth and nail to prove his innocence. After a grueling trial, the Sessions Court delivered its verdict, finding Dan and Joy guilty of all the offenses and sentencing him to death. But this was just the beginning of a legal battle that would captivate the nation. Demanded that he be allowed to touch the feet of the jail doctor, Basudeb Mukherjee, as a final plea. Wish. The Calcutta High Court and the Supreme Court of India upheld the conviction and death sentence, considering the crime committed by Danny as a heinous combination of offenses. He was executed in Kolkata on the 14th of August 2004 after a period of over 14 years. The fact that he was entrusted with the victim's safety as a security guard made it fall into the rarest category of crimes, warranting the maximum punishment. Did you like the video? Want more excitement? Stay tuned by clicking on any of the cards on your screen for more exciting content. Until next time, M.